surpass penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for spending your morning with us, or part of your morning. I hope you're having a nice day so far. So I picked myself a title before I really knew what I was going to say, which is kind of what you do in the trade. You want an impressive sounding title, and then you have to live up to it, you know. So I picked this title, All Things Are a Teacher. And for some reason I had a pretty hard time coming up with a talk, so we'll see how it goes. Because part of me feels like there's some really simple and foundational things that we would like to share with the broader community about, you know, pretty small but important ways we can work with our hearts and work with our minds and simple practices of meditation and mindfulness, you know, that really make a difference. That are almost like so simple it's embarrassing, you know, and you wouldn't think they would work, but we've tried them, you know, we've given them a thorough clinical trial for 20, 30 years, and they work. So part of me feels like I could just say that and maybe in 5 minutes, and that would be plenty. But then I always want to say more. I want to try to understand, you know, how does my heart work? How am I happy, and how am I stuck, and how does this sort of human life go, and can I say anything that would help your human life? And then the more I think about that, like, the more complicated it gets and the more confusing, you know, because we have this powerful desire to understand our life, right? We want to really feel and understand the shape of our life and have it make sense. And so I sit down with my computer at the middle of the night with my, try to write these talks, you know, try to make sense of life and say something helpful. And I think it's just getting harder to do that. And maybe the gig with this kind of thing is that, you know, the more you, it sounds a little cliche, but I think it's true, you know, the more you pay attention, the more you learn, the more sort of subtle and nuanced and a little bit confusing this life is. Our parents and our grade school teachers somehow led us to believe it was going to be sort of simple after a certain point, but it seems not to be the case. So I'll try to say something about All Things Are Our Teacher, but I'm going to say that little preamble so I feel a little bit off the hook, you know, and I could just give my talk. And you would know that I don't know. And I have confidence that you don't know either, so we're okay. Or maybe you do know. Would someone like to take over? Well, this phrase I picked, All Things Are Our Teacher, is adapted from Zen ordination rituals that through Zen Buddhism, I and the people here and other places who practice it, we inherit some phrases and some ritual motions and some sort of a sort of container of understanding, which then we try to inhabit. And one of those most powerful rituals is an ordination ritual. And we have sort of like priest ordinations, like every other religion. But we also have a sort of a lay initiation that revolves around ethical conduct. We have a sort of ethics ceremony, which I think is one of the great things that Zen can share with the world, is a sort of powerful, sort of ritually empowered way of engaging with our life as moral conduct, as ethical conduct. And so we have, like all religions, we have a list of guidelines and rules and things. But it's given to us in a sort of powerful ceremony. It's, you know, you study it and then it's given to you. And anyway, in that ceremony it says, from now on, enlightenment is your teacher. Buddha is your teacher. All being is your teacher. It says being singular. All being is your teacher. Do not put another head on top of your own. This is the path of mercy for all existence and things. And that's a famous Zen phrase in there, isn't that interesting? Do not put another head on top of your own. So all things are our teacher. So I think firstly there are some obvious implications that we all think about, which is that when stuff happens, and seemingly happens to us, how do we respond? And can we work with that response? Can we turn that response in some way into an opportunity for learning, an opportunity for growth? So let's just take a minute now, just individually, and think about what comes to mind just right away. What's something that happened to you recently that you did not like? Because those are often fertile ground, you know. What's something that happened to you recently that you did not like? Does anything come to mind? There seems to usually be a pretty good collection of things that we did not like. And then think, well, how did you respond to that? It could be something minor, you know, and sometimes minor things are the most interesting because you can work with them. It could be something minor that just got into your skin, happened. Or maybe something major happened to you recently or a long time ago, and it's still the first thing that comes to mind. Some really difficult thing happened. So how did you interact with that experience? One thing right away is we notice that everything is just experience. We conventionally tell ourselves, so-and-so did something to me, or such-and-so happened. But it's always a sort of simplification in a story after the fact. So let's try, when we're remembering this thing we didn't like, what was, you know, to reflect, like, what was the actual experience? Not just the story, if you can remember. And then there are always secondary experiences, right? Something happens, you respond to it, and then you have a response to your own response, right? Like, oh my God, I can't believe I said that, you know? It's terrible. Or why, what's wrong with her, you know? Why would she do that? And then if you reflect on your experience, usually we try to find some way to sort of sew it all up in the end, to make sense of it and move on. Now, I think this phrase, all things are our teacher, suggests that there's always something we can learn. Always something that is being offered to us, even when we don't like it. Even including the most incomprehensible and difficult situations that we face. And so bringing up this phrase all by itself can be helpful. We can bring up the phrase with our reactivity, with our excitement, with our whatever it is, and think to ourselves, all things are our teacher? And see what happens. You know, and sometimes it's obvious that there are things that we can learn from difficult situations. Conventional sort of pointers for how to live and how to avoid trouble and how to help people and how to be a little bit nicer or a little bit something. And that's great. But sometimes it really doesn't seem that way. It may just sort of feel like, no, it's just a disaster. There's nothing to learn from that. Or, that was just his fault. My conduct was exemplary. There's nothing to learn from that. But sometimes if you can stay with it, stay with your experience, bringing up this possibility, allowing the space in your heart for this possibility that even if you don't see a thing to learn, maybe there is something. Not like sort of beating yourself up and micromanaging your mind and like, what's wrong with me? I can't think of something to learn. I need to like write something down. You know? But to just open the space. Maybe the teaching is more of a feeling, not even something that can be verbalized or thought about. Maybe all things of our teacher suggest more of just a sense of possibility, an inkling in the corner of our mind, something we see out of the edge of our eye, just like, a feeling of spaciousness that we didn't realize was possible within that kind of situation. Sometimes shifts in the heart happen in ways that we don't really understand. So I want to recommend the practice of phrases like this that can really operate in that way. But something like all things are our teacher can only really function if there's space in our life. Our human life seems not to be mechanical, even though we kind of wish it was, and science kind of wishes that our life was sort of mechanical. Like it would be nice if we could sort of fix our problems, just like fixing a machine. With the right teachings or the right practices or the right therapies or by picking the right friends or the right spouses or getting the right job or all the things that we're always trying to do. Maybe it would be nice if that could just sort of fix things up. But it seems to be more subtle than that. And haven't you noticed that the times in your life, there are times in your life when you're too busy, too overwhelmed, too caught up, or too distracted. And it feels like there's sort of like no space to turn around, and things loom much larger. And when there's no space, it's hard for something like all things are our teacher to operate. When there's no space, that just becomes one more thing, you know what I mean? One more project, you know? Gosh, I forgot about all things are our teacher today, and I forgot this, and I didn't do that, and I'm really stressed out about the meeting tomorrow, and so on. So it seems to be what we're finding in Buddhist practice in America is we can't exactly fix our heart, but we can make effort to create space, and in that space, transformation really is possible. And in that space, phrases and turning words and teachings really can make a difference. So I think it's really true that part of our responsibility, if we want to be happier and more connected human beings, is to take care of that space. To operate our lives so that we have a little bit of room. And you are all obviously doing that. You had time, you had 2 hours to blow on a Buddhist lecture. So that's fantastic. That's great. And I'm sure you're also using your time in other wise ways. And there are many ways to maintain the space. One way that we all probably can work on is just simply not being so busy. And looking at the causes and conditions that impel us towards our busyness. It's a sort of shared, powerful shared story that we have, right? That it's absolutely inevitable to be too busy. Don't you think? Isn't it absolutely inevitable that you're going to be too busy? We all believe that, and we tell each other that all the time. When you run into somebody in the store, and you ask them, oh, how's work going, or how's this going? It would be like kind of strange if they said, oh, I'm really relaxed, I'm not too busy, right? You would be like, what? What you expect them to say is, oh, it's going fine, but I'm a bit too busy, right? That's what we expect. And we reinforce in each other. So why is that? We might want to look at that as a society. So that helps, not to be so busy. But also there are some kinds of doing that do seem to help with this. Meditation practice definitely helps with this. I'm sure that prayer or regular walks in the woods or doing like some kind of creative work with a good spirit, there are a lot of things that can help. And we all have some sense of what helps me hold the space. And maybe we're also all curious to see what are the other possibilities for doing that in my life. Or else, why else would we be here? But meditation does have some advantages, so I want to make a little plug for meditation. The first advantage of meditation is it's really simple to do. There's very little equipment needed. We have these elegant looking sets of cushions that cost about $80, but a couch cushion is fine. You don't even need that. All you really need for meditation is a human body, and breathing is useful too, if you're still breathing. So it's very simple. You don't need much equipment. You need just sort of, initially you just need very simple introductory instructions. You don't need to go to school. You don't need to get a doctorate in meditation for it to be useful to you. And this simplicity, I think maybe kind of is a bit of a barrier for us. We basically think that since our life is so complicated and our problems are so complicated, whatever the solution might be is definitely, like, it's got to be even more complicated, right, in order to sort of surround all that complicatedness with a strong enough sort of, like, net, you know, to hold it in. But somehow the simplicity of meditation can cut through all that complication, so it's very simple. And I think the reason why is meditation practice allows us to reunite with our own being. And what could be simpler than that? To just be, with nothing extra going on. To take, you know, like an actual break from our busyness and our fixing and our figuring things out. To let that go for a bit and just be a person, just be a human being. And we can add many highfalutin words to this experience if we want. This maybe is connecting with our natural awakened nature, or maybe it's being able to be in a relationship to God, or maybe it's any number of words, but really it's just being. And it seems to be, surprisingly to us, because of our sort of conjured idea of how the world works, that if we spend time regularly just being, that spaciousness is there, and there is a kind of a natural healing and opening process that can happen. And within that space, it can be skillful to add some teaching, like all things are our teacher, and just see what that is. See how that functions for ourselves. So maybe instead of just talking about it, we should try that for a minute. Would that be a good idea? You've been sitting there for a little while already, and one thing I want to make a point about with meditation is that it's not actually a mental process. You would think so. You would think meditation would be a mental process, but it turns out to be a whole body-mind process that includes all of our physicality. So let's stand up for a moment, just right where you are. And however is helpful to you, just take a little stretch. And remember that we have a body. Take care of the body for a minute. Feel the body. down on our cushion or our chair. It's nice in the chair to kind of sit a little bit forward in the chair, not to lean so much against the back, and to plant the feet parallel on the floor. If you want to sit on a cushion, it's helpful to kind of sit on the front of the cushion. And then it's helpful to tilt the pelvis forward just a little bit, make a little bit of an arch in the low back, which just supports the back in kind of a natural S curve. And then on an inhalation, let's notice our spine, the backbone of everything, holds us up. And maybe we could let the spine just be gently a little bit, don't force it, but a little bit longer, just inhaling a little bit of length and openness, and then exhaling, just letting go of tension. Maybe there's tension in the shoulders. Inhaling, making a little length, a little openness. Exhaling, noticing tension and just sort of releasing it down into the earth. Letting that exhalation go. The eyes could be open and gazing downward. In Zen, we do have the eyes open, which we find helpful for awareness and presentness. But the eyes closed is fine also. Once we've established a little feeling of openness and relaxed feeling in the body, let's see if we can just be simply present with the breathing and the body. Just noticing the breathing coming and going. When thoughts arise, we notice I'm thinking. Then we just gently return our awareness to the present moment with this helpful tool of the breathing. If we hear a sound or see a sight, we can do the same thing. Notice that we are having a sensation and just return to awareness of breathing in the body. So it's very simple. And if there is some secondary drama going on about whether we're good at this or bad at it, or whether our neighbor is probably really good at it or something, we can notice that too, and also just return to awareness of the breathing in the body. Okay, we'll try this maybe for 3 or 4 minutes. I'll ring a bell. You can listen to the bell. It's very peaceful to listen to the bell. And then I'll ring the bell again when we are ready to stop. How about? We'll try that. Thank you for giving that a spin. And you were sitting so quietly before the talk, too. Isn't that nice to get to be with a group of people and just sit quietly, you know, sort of liberated from, like, chit-chat, you know? And that's the other thing that little by little we're learning in Zen practice, is that there's a kind of a warm and there are many kinds of silence, you know. There is a kind of warm, companionable silence, you know, that really includes everybody. There are also many negative kinds of silence, too, which we also know about, right? So a few more thoughts from me about all things are our teacher. And then after that, we'll take a little break. And some of us, if you would like to stay, could have a little discussion, and I'd be very interested to hear what you think. Let's see. Actually, I have quite a few more thoughts about all things. Pages of them, so I'll try to condense it down a little bit. It always happens. Well, one thing is, all things are teachers seems to be a sort of intentional shifting of our relationship to life and our desires. That one of the things that Buddha taught that's pretty clear, that really makes sense, is that our sort of persistent, deep desire for things always to be just a little bit different from how they are gives us a lot of trouble. Which is not to say we should all become passive. We need to creatively engage in working with our life and our world. The Buddha taught that too. But he suggested that it's possible to also be liberated from this sort of niggly feeling that we always, I think, have if we notice, if we're not too busy, you know. That, oh, you know, that's pretty good, but, you know. And kind of like our social talk about busyness, we also have the same social talk about our accomplishments, right? Yeah, I did pretty good, but, right? Because it wasn't quite. And aren't we a little bit that way with everything? We wish our bodies were a little bit different. We wish our close friends were maybe just a little bit different. They're pretty good the way they are, but just a little bit different. We wish the whole world was a little different, or a lot different. And we certainly wish that there was no death. Or maybe like a life very well lived according to certain criteria at about 93, it would be okay. But other times, no. We wish that. We wish that there was no suffering and no trouble and no illness. And we definitely wish that the things we like would stay around forever. Impermanence is really a bummer for us. And we wish we could avoid things we don't like. We wish they would not come into our life. So I want to toss another phrase in. Because last weekend we were studying a 12th century Japanese famous Zen master named Dogen. And he has a great phrase about that tendency. He said, in attachment, flowers fall. In aversion, weeds spread. In attachment, flowers fall. In aversion, weeds spread. So the things that we cling to and really want to not change are like flowers, right? And the more we cling to them, the more likely we are to have to watch them fall apart, right? And then the same in reverse, you know, the things that we really want to avoid seem to just multiply when we go at it with that attitude. Like, there's certain people you'd rather not chat with in the grocery store. Why do they always go shopping when you go shopping? It's like, you know, it's a law from deep spiritual practice, you know. But they're there for a reason, you know. All things are our teacher, right? So you hear about these sort of teachings about attachment and aversion and stuff, and it sounds like what they're saying is, I'm not supposed to be attached to anything. I'm just sort of maybe it'd be better if I was just sort of neutral and uninvolved and uninterested in the world. Then I wouldn't have any problems. But that doesn't work. The antidote to the sort of problems of attachment and wanting things not to be they are and not wanting to learn from things seems not to be detachment, but rather loving even more deeply, engaging our life even more deeply, but seeing if we can release that love from the strings and bindings and conditions. And we had a literal example of this phrase last weekend. We had this big retreat and people came, and maybe some of you were here last week. And one of the students here noticed that the flowers on the altar were kind of droopy. And she was upset about that and wanted to go to the florist. And I was tempted to stop her, because we can learn to love drooping flowers. And we need to do that. But she wanted to, and I didn't want to be mean, so she got new flowers. But there's a way that we can make our life into nothing but running to the florist. Nothing but fussing and fixing to try to prop up the sky instead of allowing it to fall, with faith that we will be able to get up again. So all things are our teacher seems to include this understanding that attachment and aversion are another thing that bind us and prevent us from having that space to learn and grow. And all things of our teacher seems to encourage a kind of a deep commitment to living our life with what we actually have, to approaching things the way they actually are, with full presence. And recognizing, and meditation helps with this too, recognizing that the only room we have, you know, the only place we have to work is this moment, you know, with this body, with this education, with this situation. There's kind of no later. You know, we have this idea of later I'll be able to deal with such and so. Later I'll be able to deal with my mom's problems because, you know, right now, no. But there's no later. And so all things are our teacher is kind of a radical re-engagement with what's actually happening right now in our life, recognizing that's the only place where we can operate. And as we study that, we notice that when we're sort of tight and resistant to our life the way it is, there's a kind of a sort of a almost a kind of a greed there. We're kind of trying to hold on to something tightly. And one of the other things that Buddhism can offer is some suggested antidotes to difficult mental tendencies like greed and tightness and aversion. And what they suggest as the antidote to sort of greed and desire is generosity. Is generosity. So even if we don't feel like it, bring up the practice of being generous. To give more in whatever way we can. But, you know, it's a strange world, right? The minute you start thinking about how am I going to give more, it gets very complicated. I was thinking about this because the other day a friend's car suddenly broke in a really weird way. So I don't know if you know much about cars, but her clutch plate, she had a car with a manual transmission, right? The clutch snapped in half. The mechanic had never seen this before. Never had been heard of before. The clutch plate just snapped in half. Usually they wear out and other things go wrong. You know, all kinds of things go wrong, but this had never happened before, you know. And she had to suddenly pay $1,100 to fix her car. And it made sense to do that. She'd already invested so much in her car. It was a little painful, I think, to hand over the credit card at that moment. But she did, and drove the car away, and tried to forget about it, you know, as we do. But it just made me think about money and generosity and value and the strange mixed-up world we live in, because a few weeks before that, my wife and I had sent $500, you know, less than half of that, to an AIDS orphan girl in Kenya. A girl we'd been sponsoring before through a local nonprofit, the Slum Doctor Program. we helped this girl get through high school, and she'd done really well in high school, and she'd qualified for university, which is hard to do there, I think. And the few kids that do qualify for university, it's a little bit subsidized by the state, but they still have to come up with about $500 for a year of college, which sounds like nothing to us. $500 for a year of college, you know. We're meant to put like $500 every month in our, you know, college savings plan for our son, I think, you know, not for, you know, until he's 18, you know, so. But it's a huge amount of money for her, of course, so we did that, and she's going to be able to go to college, hopefully. But what makes sense here? A clutch plate? 2 years of college for a smart, hard-working girl whose parents have died from AIDS? Do we have to decide that? How is that all things are our teacher? How do we learn from that weird situation that we live in? We a little bit try to avoid how strange and messed up and confusing and not understandable the world is. Should my friend not have fixed the clutch plate and just sent money to Kenya? Stuff breaks. That teaches us too. Kenyan AIDS orphans work hard, or they don't, or they fail, or they succeed, or they die too. How do we respond? Will we succeed when we respond? Or will we also fail? Can we get up again? All things are our teacher. Cecile, I was having a hard time with this talk. It's like, the more you think about it, the more it's like, what do you do? How do you live? How can we let this life teach us and give back? Because this whole mess is not exactly our fault. It's not exactly our fault being born in good circumstances and having things like vehicles that have clutch plates inside them. I think Mercy Akumbo, the girl we're sponsoring, has no ambition to ever own a private vehicle in her lifetime. That's beyond what she could imagine. So it's not our fault, but somehow this life is our responsibility. That we are given this body and mind, and whatever pile of material possessions comes to us for just a short time. And then it's all gone. Can we use them well? And live in the best way we can? Can we be and find a sane and happy way to be guardians of the whole world? The clutch breaks and we fix it. The world breaks. We do our best to fix that too. But here's the thing that makes this impossible task actually doable. And that is, you can't do it. You can't do it. You can't be this separate person over here fixing that world over there. It's like too huge and too impossible. If we tried to do that, we would just go nuts. It seems to be the only way to approach this world and to really approach all things are our teacher is if we do it in cooperation with everybody. I can't do it. You can't do it. But we can do it. We can all do it. So that's why, I don't know if you noticed this, I've been saying all things are our teacher, not all things are my teacher. There's a huge difference. And not I am the teacher of all things either. Practicing all things are our teacher brings us back to this sort of massive web of interdependence and support that we actually live in. And we get softer little by little about this abstraction that we carry around called me. Do I really need to defend me in the same way I thought I did? does this me need the same thing, need all these things I thought it did, or does it need different things? And who is me anyway? If we look, will we find me? Am I in my brain? Am I in my thinking? Am I in my bones? Where is me anyway? And we don't know. But maybe we can learn to let that really be okay and just take the next step. And I think my kind of last word on this is, for now, is that all things are our teacher seems to fundamentally be a sort of massive expression of trust. Trusting ourselves to be larger than ourselves. Trusting our hearts to open to the whole universe. Knowing that we won't get it right, trusting that whatever efforts we make are enough and are just right. And that when we make a mistake, which we will, trusting that too. All things are our teacher. So anyway, you're welcome to come and explore those questions together here in about 5 minutes. We'll have a little question and answer discussion time. And also, if you want to come back another time and take up meditation practice, you're very welcome. You just got most of the introduction already. It's pretty simple. And there's a lot of literature in the table in the lobby. And there are three or four other meditation centers in town. Like Bellingham's sort of amazing in a way. You know, there's a richness of meditation centers and churches and synagogues and also forests and beaches and mountains. We're really blessed. We have a very supportive, really good conditions for practice. So many people trying their best to be all you can be. That's probably commercial, but... Is that the army? You know what I mean. If there's any merit, Buddhism has this mysterious idea of merit, so we want to dedicate the merit. If there's any merit generated from our practice together and our thinking about this morning, let's give that merit to the people in the world and the beings who need it the most, the many people suffering today. And I've particularly been thinking of the people in Sumatra who I think are in terrible shape, and it's kind of slipped out of the headlines, but we might practice generosity towards them and all the other people who need it. So, thank you very much. Let's please enjoy a 5-minute break, and if you have time to stick around, I'm very happy to spend another 15 or 20 minutes together and maybe be out of here by 11:15, 11:20. And if you have a kid downstairs, that's fine. Shelby's here till 11:30. And I hear a little bit, so I hope somebody gave Shelby some business. And do let your friends with kids know. It's pretty rare and unusual in the American Buddhist world to have a practice event with childcare. For some reason, we're not very good at it. So, you know, help us get some traction. Bring your friends and who have kids, and they can come next week or the week after. All right, so thank you very much for listening.